Celebrating diversity. This is Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
Bob was on his way to work just after dropping the two boys off at a private high school, I believe, in Nairobi. He was on the way to the embassy. And he was broadsided at a stoplight at 60 miles an hour by a reinforced Land Rover. He was killed instantly. The Brit that supposedly was drunk at 7 in the morning was taken to the hospital and immediately disappears. And all the evidence he had given in the way of documentation was proven to be phony as to who he was, and Bob was killed. And it was a hit. And it's always concerned me today that he had gotten a little too close to who had been involved with Siemens implantable chip technology. We'd been trying to, for a couple of years then, quietly trying to find out who had been doing it without our government realizing it was going on. Because whoever it is has got total ability to penetrate anytime, anywhere, our government, instantly.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. State-sponsored child sexual abuse. The course of justice is perverted at the VI paedophile inquiry, but will heads roll? Whatever happened to Lowell Goddard, the third chair of the VI paedophile inquiry, went back home to New Zealand last month, and just as she was about to appear at the Home Affairs Select Committee, Keith Vaz was sacked. No doubt she left after having signed a confidentiality agreement, so survivors of sexual abuse are left wondering why. And leaks suggest it's because she wasn't happy with her staff. Well, the inquiry's number one lawyer, Ben Emerson, has been suspended and now has resigned as well. The new chair, Alexis Jay, is not saying anything about it. So why was the head of the inquiry forced to employ Home Office staff who were themselves under suspicion over the child sex abuse cover-up? Is this all part of a government and civil service attempt to derail the inquiry, which could expose leading figures in government, civil service, children's charities like the NSPCC even, the church, the BBC and even royalty to prosecution? Also, today's funeral of Shimon Peres, the Israeli Prime Minister. We remember this show's fleeting encounter with him, wanting access all areas to the in the run-up to the 2012 London Olympics, and access after the ousting of G4S that he was denied. Also, a commander of the al-Nusra Front in Syria, now known as the Sham Liberation Front, he admits to being supported by the Pentagon. So why haven't we been told that on the news? Finally, we break the taboo of religion and politics. Which god do many rich and powerful people worship, if any? Our sister show Dialect is back at noon every Tuesday now. This week, author of Swallow This, The Dark Secrets of the Food Industry, with author Joanna Blythman. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday, or download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. First, I'm joined on the line by child sex abuse survivor Sam Hill. Hi, Sam. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony. Hi.
First of all, what's your reaction to the news this week that that Ben Emerson, the leading lawyer in the inquiry, has first of all suspended and then he's decided to resign?
Well, there's not much transparency regarding what really is going on, but I've spoken to a few survivors, Esther Baker, and a few people I know, and they're quite glad to see him go. They didn't think he was really good for the job.
But he's been there for the last 2 years doing this, and we've seen a whole succession of various chairs of this inquiry disappearing, really, as they're appointed. We've had, first of all, Baroness Butler-Schloss and Fiona Wolfe, both of who were connected to Leon Britton and the era where Leon Britton, former Home Secretary, was supposed to have covered this up back in the 1980s. And then there was Lowell Goddard. She was removed as well. She's now back in New Zealand, but nobody's really quite sure why she left. And and now we've got this person, Alexis J.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I said at the top of the hour just there about whether there's you think this is being derailed deliberately. Do you think there's any chance that this will succeed, this inquiry?
Well, eventually, the people keep dropping out. One or two of the bad ones will go, and perhaps, you know, something more will develop, something better, because, you know, maybe he was the problem, and maybe we'll actually have somebody who'll stick with the job now.
Well, what's your own thoughts about this whole thing, which was floated really at the time that Alexis J, was appointed and Lowell Goddard left, which is the idea of employing a whole load of civil servants from the Home Office in this job?
No, that doesn't seem very satisfactory, does it? Because these institutions themselves are going to be under the spotlight, and, you know, there'll be, you know, massive claims of people wanting to get insurance. So they're going to want to safeguard that, aren't they? They're working for them.
Now, one of the main things that the Home Office does, of course, is it oversees the police, and it does things like administers cuts to the police at the moment. And so the police, what's your thoughts about the way the police have dealt with these claims over the last 40, 50 years even?
Well, I think they're very status orientated, and they're very much sort of tipping their hat to people who, you know, they fear condemning or bringing to justice, and they've been told not to bring them to justice, haven't they? So it's very easy for them then to sort of scoop up the remains of, you know, whoever comes to them and divert them very often away from justice. So I think it's reputation management a lot of the time within the institutions. On one side, they want to uphold the reputations of the powerful. On the other side, if someone's been vulnerable in care or any other system, mental health system or anything, they can use that to stigmatise and steer them away from justice. And they can actually, you know, manipulate the records rather than dealing with huge amounts of paperwork, which they'll be dealing with now in the inquiry regarding all the things that they've covered up. If they can steer people away, as they did in Rotherham, by saying, we don't want to handle these people, they're the wrong sort of people making these accusations, they will do that, and they have been doing that.
There's another side to this, of course, and if someone is appointed to run the inquiry, one would have thought it was taken as read that they could decide who to employ as their staff and who they trusted, because these staff are going to be dealing with a massive amount of confidential paperwork, etc. And if the person running the inquiry doesn't trust their own staff, that might be a problem almost from the word go.
Yes, it would be a huge problem, yes. I don't know how it could be resolved.
And what's your own experience been with the police? Who, let's just remind listeners, I mean, the Home Office is intimately connected with the police, over the years. If you could just tell us what your dealings, times you've been to the police and how you've been dealt with.
They were very dismissive because of the people I was made accusations towards. They were dismissive because of their status and the fact my status had been set quite early on in life. I'd suffered emotionally and sort of been vulnerable, and they looked upon that as some sort of reason not to bother, really.
Now, I know you were initially sexually abused when you were around about 11, 12 years old. When did you first decide to actually talk to the police about all this?
I wanted to talk to the police at one point when I was 16, but that's when everyone closed ranks against me, and I was steered towards mental health as if I was, you know, something wrong with me.
So let's just get this clear. You were threatening to talk to the police about the abuse, and then your abusers kind of managed to get you sectioned, is that right?
Well, yes, and my family closed ranks, and they all moved house. They weren't prepared. Nobody was prepared to deal with it. I was always the problem. I was seen as the problem. But unfortunately, what happens then is the state will continue seeing you as the problem very often, because what they have written about you, what they have decided about you, carries on. You can't go back and say, you know, I am not, you know, what you've written on your record about me is not true. They write these records about people, and it's used, you know, in a way to sort of defer you away from any form of civil justice.
Now, I suppose one of the main backstops when any kind of sexual abuse happens is the parents. Just tell us a little bit about what happened with your own parents when you spoke to them.
They were very young. They weren't keen to discuss any of it. I was always told to move on with my life, forget it, turn around, don't walk back, don't look back, sort of thing, which really isn't possible, because sooner or later it will rear up again and the memories will return.
But aren't you tempted to do that now, to just say, look, I've had enough of this?
To gain some sort of justice, you mean? To be
Well, no, I mean, to just say, look, I mean, it's been a really terrible trial to go through at the time, this abuse. Yeah. But then to have almost every time that you are trying to get something done about it, it's almost like a kind of another form of abuse.
It is. The records that they make on you, once you are known to the authorities, you may not have done anything wrong, but you know, you may have had mental health problems, you may even just be vulnerable, you may have been homeless, you know, your status is always sort of questioned. And these people that I, you know, who were involved in the abuse, their status would never be questioned because they were completely above being questioned.
Now, I know you were in a situation at one time where you were actually forced really back with your abuser because you were homeless. Tell us how that happened.
I was forced. Oh yes, indeed. He and I were living together. I was controlled by him into my mid-20s. Sadly enough, but I mean, he had used the authorities against me, my mental health history. I had a breakdown at 19 and managed to pull all sorts of strings. And I tried to run away from him, went to stay in a hotel in my hometown. And they said to him, oh, you know, she's gone. Do you want us to call the police and bring her back? And eventually I was. They caught up with me on the motorway and brought me back to him. So I couldn't escape.
Well, that sounds pretty horrific. Yeah. But what about your more recent contacts with the police? Because I know after the Jimmy Savile scandal, I mean, this sort of rears its head, it seems, every few years or so. What was your latest experience with the police? Just take us through that.
Yes. I approached them about 7 or 8 months ago in reasonably good faith because I thought times have changed and I'd managed to build up my self-esteem, being around a very nice group of people, helping, making positive progress with the CSA campaigning, only to be brought back to square one again, to where I was all those times before when I'd made complaints. And tried to go to the police. I was waiting for 6 months. They had hardly any contact with me until I spoke to Esther Baker, who told me, oh, well, you know, you should be getting updates every month. Oh, well, that's not been happening. There's something wrong here. I'd been talking to Exaro, and they said, well, look, should we ring them on your behalf, find out what's happening? I was just told just to sort of wait because I didn't want to seem like I was pushing them. So eventually I contacted them. It was almost 6 months after my first police interview, and they said, oh, well, it's been dropped. It was dropped 4 weeks ago, and no one had told me. There wasn't somebody extra working on the case, as they'd told me there would be. There was actually somebody reviewing me, going over all my medical notes, and just dismissing my evidence, not interviewing anybody, and no one had told me.
So what's your experience to be almost like treated as the perpetrator rather than the victim again?
Yeah. Well, you just get stigmatised by the state, and it's very useful. I think abusers probably realise this in a way, that they have the advantage, they have more power in society, and you're going to spend a lot of years, you know, recovering. So, you know, if you can't break away from them, a family who are complicit and people like that, then you're going to be held down, you know, basically, and the state will carry on that as well.
Now, I noticed earlier on 5 Live on the BBC, lots of suggestions that this inquiry should be shut down. What do you think?
No, I don't think it should. I think we've got to keep going. I think we really need to keep going, and there really need to be some legal changes made, like reporting, mandatory reporting, and the Official Secrets Act not being used to protect powerful paedophiles. So many changes need to be made. We haven't had really any progress. We need something. Otherwise, people are going to get very, very disheartened.
Now, Martin Summers, I'll just bring you in here, because Sir Peter Hayman, who was the deputy head of MI6, the Foreign Intelligence Service, he was one of the people who was implicated in this paedophilia, but many of these people have died. And is it actually impossible for the state to investigate itself?
Well, it shouldn't be. I mean, in theory, the police are supposedly independent of the intelligence services, although often they're not. And you know, my suspicion is that the intelligence services have used abuse as a tool to blackmail various people at the top of society to make sure that they do what they're supposed to be, you know, do as they're told, and that this is really underlying all of this. That you've got the general power imbalance which has been mentioned. which is obviously, you know, a big issue with in this kind of case. But I think also the state itself has used child abuse as a tool. So Kincorra Boys Home in Northern Ireland, it's a big issue over there. MI5 were using it as a place to blackmail targets who were they would be filmed having sex with underage boys and then blackmailed subsequently. And I think that this is the reason why the state's so paranoid about all this coming out, because it's sort of it shows the dark side of what they do.
Well, I would use the word afraid, not paranoid. I mean, they've got every right to be afraid, because you're talking about effectively a criminal cover-up. What's your take on this whole idea of using Home Office staff to run this inquiry?
Well, what it looks at like from the outside is that they're using this kind of investigation and inquiry in order to try and basically cover their backsides. That's what British inquiries generally do, and I don't think we should give up on inquiries, but on the other hand, you've got to recognise that the strategy of inquiry from the point of view of the state is to make this stuff go away, or at least put it on the back burner. It's not to get to the bottom of it, but it's up to everybody else to make sure that the inquiry doesn't do that.
Also, how far high up do you think this goes? Because, I mean, I mentioned the royal family, but, you know, Jimmy Savile was very friendly with them. They were also involved in the cover-up in Jersey, in making sure that the abusers, both sexual and abusers in the mental health, that is, putting people who are mentally ill in solitary confinement for long periods of time, that they were allowed to keep their jobs.
Well, if as I suspect, that child abuse is not just a random thing, but has actually been used as a tool by the intelligence services to blackmail various top politicians and others, then that will be the bottom line. They don't want it to come out, because they will have gone out of their way to encourage this kind of behaviour, so that those engaged in the behaviour can be subsequently blackmailed.
Now, in a couple of weeks, we're going to be looking at the anniversary of the Dutroux scandal in Belgium. So it's not just Britain. It may even be that this is going on in many countries, and Britain is just the only country that's grappling with it, trying to deal with it.
I'm afraid the idea of using sex with underage people as a means of blackmailing, is definitely, it's just one of the tools of the trade of the secret services, whether British or anybody else. And I'm afraid that's probably what we're going to find if we get to the bottom of this. Although whether we will ever get to the bottom of it is another matter, because, of course, there's a lot of vested interest to prevent that from happening.
Bit by bit, of course, though, the information is trickling out about who's just talking the talk and who's actually walking the walk as part of this child sex abuse inquiry. Sam, can I ask you what your thoughts are about what should happen next, and whether you think that that Alexis Jay, who's in charge of this inquiry now, after Lowell Goddard, it looks as if was bullied out, whether she's the right person for the job?
I think we've just got to give her time, and something has to start happening, really. Then we can judge whether it's working or not.
What about the way that Lowell Goddard was removed? Have you followed any of that? Because I certainly saw that there were rumours that effectively she was elbowed out because she was not happy with Ben Emmerson, who's now, of course, gone.
Yes, well, that's interesting. Will we ever know? It's all shrouded in secrecy. And, you know, she said she missed her family. Would she have ever really taken the job in the first place if she was going to miss her family?
And we were about to find out what it was all about at the Home Affairs Select Committee, when suddenly Keith Vaz is caught in some kind of sting operation, the chair of that committee, and disappears off the face. Well, he certainly wasn't chair of the committee anymore. What if you were in the Home Secretary's position, Amber Rudd, at the moment, what would you be up to, Sam?
Oh, that's a difficult question. I think I would be listening to survivors. I think we're the ones with the knowledge, and we have really been stigmatised, and it's just, you know, it's sort of endemic of what we've experienced throughout, and we need to be listened to. We're not this, you know, these emotional people who are going to get it wrong. We would actually get it right. We want to point people in the right direction to regards what happened and what went wrong.
And in your own case, could you just explain to us the way you understand that the establishment was able to protect your abusers rather than to prosecute them?
I think it's sort of just the workload, that they fear the workload of actually, you know, dealing with things. It makes it much easier just to keep the status quo. If someone's vulnerable, we'll keep them in that position. We won't rock the boat by sort of giving them their full rights and encouraging them to take action and helping them find proof, etc. They just keep the status quo and they follow the orders and the instructions they get from higher up. And basically, you know, it's they process people and stigmatize people frequently. But I don't know how it can really be changed. But it's the whole ethos of our institutions really needs a bit of a looking at.
Well, I think it's to be you're to be commended for carrying on the fight, and I think there has been a sea change in understanding that this is the sort of thing that goes on. I mean, a few years ago, if you'd said that senior people in this country were involved in child sex abuse, it wouldn't have rung true to many people. But of course, with all the revelations about Jimmy Savile and so on, people are now more aware of the issues. It's one step forward, two steps back, isn't it?
Yeah.
But we've got to carry on because future generations require this to be sorted out so that it's put a stop to.
Sam, I know you're on Twitter. How can people follow your stuff? And I know you've also written a book too.
Yes, I'm Sam Hill 12 12 12 on Twitter, and I've written a book called An Oath to Hell, which was my oath being thrown to hell by all the institutions and never being able to go to court, and you know, and the Hippocratic Oath being broken. So it's really quite a prominent book. It describes the institutions and my dealings with them, really.
And what's your thoughts about what the best next steps are in the national inquiry?
Well, we need to start taking evidence and making a bit of progress. Nothing really has been done, has it? I think it just needs to really sort of get into the right mood for moving forward. And, you know, maybe when it gathers pace, people will be more inclined to have a bit of faith in it.
Well, one good thing is that this business with Ben Emerson and with Lowell Goddard and various other people involved in the inquiry who have been removed from it does seem to be sorting the sheep from the goats, if I can put it like that. That is, the people who are sincerely interested in the interests of the survivors and those who are kind of there going through the motions. So anyway, that's at least one thing positive, even though it's another problem, is that people are slowly learning who it is who's serious about making this inquiry work and who isn't.
Mm-hmm.
So, Sam Hill, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show. Now, Martin, can you just sum up your thoughts about what you think the prospects are for this inquiry succeeding or not at the moment? I was actually really annoyed to hear the national media talking about saying that this inquiry should be finished and maybe that's it. It's just never going to work and everyone should just forget about it. That's what they were saying on the BBC earlier on today, suggesting anyway.
Well, at one stage there was a suggestion that the inquiry should not include Northern Ireland and should not include King Cora Boys Home, and the suggestion was that shouldn't be included because Ireland wasn't part of the jurisdiction of the United Kingdom, which, if you think about it, is a rather strange argument for the British to make, since it basically accepts the Republicans' allegation that, the Republicans demand that the six counties shouldn't be part of the UK. But anyway, they have included it, and I think there is evidence to suggest that there's a pattern involved in all of this, especially at the highest levels. And I think if you think about it, the culture of the British intelligence services, particularly MI5, MI6, tended to be a gay culture, for example, at one stage. A lot of gay men were working there. And, of course, for many, many years, gay sex was illegal in this country. So there were a kind of... Because gay sex was illegal and many of MI5, MI6 officers were gay, they generally just started to disregard that kind of aspect of the law. But at what point does having sex with underage... You know, and the age of consent was 21, and so people will be having sex with people under 21 and thinking, well, that's all right, there's nothing the matter with that. But how low, you know, the whole culture of permissiveness around that allowed this kind of culture to develop. And then, of course, you've got the use of sex, illicit sex, as a means of blackmail. And that's pretty much what appears to have been happening at the King Cora Boys Home. Now, we know about the King Cora Boys Home, that there's also suggestions that children's homes in North Wales and other parts of the country, if you were a secret service that wanted to use children as sex objects to blackmail politicians and others, then you would go to children's homes.
Martin, the survivors group at Shirley Oaks, which has been been very vocal recently, which is in South London, they have been saying effectively when the people that they were going to report sexual abuse in care were themselves paedophiles.
Well, that's right. So what you've got is a whole... They've got a distinction. There's a paedophile subculture within things like care homes, which is... And you know, wherever people... You know, paedophiles, we know, are quite devious at getting access to young people. But, of course, the VIP paedophiles, what we're talking about here, Andy Heyman, he was second in command of MI6, and he was found, some stuff was found on a bus, you know, photographs. He'd left them on the bus. The police went round to him and said, well, what's all this about? But he was let off. And I think that the culture of paedophilia is ingrained in the intelligence services.
I mean, it would be okay, wouldn't it, if it was just, say, one institution, but it seems as if it's systematic, where you've got social services, police all covering up and nobody able to...
If you're going to have a systematic program of encouraging child abuse for political reasons, then you're going to have a pretty substantial cover-up operation ready to go. And don't forget, we're talking about people who are, you know, trained intelligence officers who know how to cover their tracks and know how to pull the right strings to get the results they want.
Okay, before we leave the subject, let's just have a listen, because there's no promises questions during the conference season, but this was put a couple of weeks ago, and about the end of Lowell Goddard chairing the Child Sex Abuse Inquiry by Lisa Nandy.
Lisa Nandy!
It's been 2 years since the Prime Minister set up the Child Abuse Inquiry. It's onto its fourth chair, and last week the outgoing chair said that it had become inherently unmanageable. Since the Prime Minister appointed Dame Lowell Goddard to her position, will she insist that she comes before this House to explain herself?
Yeah.
Surely child abuse survivors deserve an explanation.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, on the process point that she's raised with me, of course, it's not for the Prime Minister to insist who attends before a committee of this House. I understand Dame Lowell Goddard has been invited to attend the committee. But what I would say on the child abuse issue is I think she and I share across this House, many honourable members, a desire to see these issues of these appalling crimes of child abuse being properly looked into. It's important that the inquiry, Dame Lowell Goddard has set up the inquiry, the Truth Project, many aspects of this which are already in place and operating. And I'm very pleased that Alexis Jay has taken on the role as chairman of the inquiry. She chaired the Rotherham work. I think she will do this work extremely well, and we will have answers to questions that so many have been asking for too long.
Well, one thing that the Prime Minister didn't say there was that Alexis Jay didn't actually recommend any kind of disciplinary action on any of the social workers or police that allowed this abuse to go on in Rotherham for something like nearly 15 years with thousands of offences, which many of which, of course, were reported to the police, but without any action.
Well, in other words, the suggestion is that the British are trying to cover things up by using their inquiry system and all the rest of it. Well, that's goes without saying. We could say, well, let's not have an inquiry at all because it's going to be a cover-up. We've got to work with what we've got and keep banging away at it.
Well, I don't think that's going to happen, because there are some people who are pretty determined to make sure this inquiry does work and that anybody that's trying to obstruct it is removed from the actual organisation of that inquiry. So we'll see what happens in future weeks.
Celebrating diversity, this is Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
Now, Martin mentioned at the top of the hour that we've had reports that one of the commanders of the UNNSRA front in Syria has actually admitted to, quite happily, to a German reporter, I think it was, to being supplied by the Pentagon.
Yeah, well, he is actually the commander of al-Nusra inside Aleppo, which is where we're all supposed to be crying crocodile tears for the terrible things that the Russians and Syrian army are doing there. But he was interviewed by a German journalist, and it's been in the mainstream media in Germany have reported this. And he's asked a straight question: are you being supported by the Americans? He's saying, yes, we are, indirectly, but we want more support, please. And you know, thanks very much for the anti-aircraft missiles, but we need some more stuff from you. Blah blah blah. This is Al Qaeda. That's what we're talking about, who are openly saying that they're in alliance with the Western intelligence service.
Right, it's the Kölner. If I try and pronounce it right, Kölner Stadt. Tanzeiger, which is the Cologne main newspaper there, that's done this interview, and they've done it with Abu Al-Ez. He reported quite openly about his financiers being Saudi Arabian, Qatari and Kuwaitis.
Yeah. So, in other words, there's a cutout here. The Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, Turkey are the direct suppliers of weaponry to al-Nusra inside Aleppo. But, of course, underlying all of that is the support from British, US and British intelligence services. And, I mean, the dogs in the street in the Middle East know that the CIA and MI6 support al-Qaeda, and they have done for years. Meanwhile, in this country, you talk to people, oh, yes, we're fighting these Muslim extremists all over the world, aren't we? Except we're not. We're arming them.
Abu Al-Az, he says about Jabhat al-Nusra, al-Nusra Front, he says, we are one part of al-Qaeda. He's quite open about being part of al-Qaeda. He says, our principles are fighting vice, pureness and security. I'm not sure if he's fighting pureness. I don't know. It really doesn't make a lot of sense, that, but maybe it's missed in the translation. He said, our affairs and our way have changed. Israel, for example, is now supporting us because Israel is also at war with Syria and with Hezbollah.
Yes, in other words, he's letting a few cats out of the bag there. I mean, there was a suggestion last week, if you remember, that the Russians had sent missiles in to knock out an operations room in northern Syria, which was stuffed with Israeli, US, Qatari, Turkish, British intelligence officers. Now, we've not heard anything about that. It was reported by the Iranians, so we've only got one source for that. But, I mean, the fact of the matter is the evidence shows, both in Libya and Syria and Afghanistan and elsewhere, that the Western intelligence services have an intimate relationship with al-Qaeda. So even if al-Qaeda did carry out the 9/11 attacks, which is very disputable, then it would be as part of an alliance with Western intelligence services, which has been going on for years, and in Syria is absolutely staring everybody in the face. Nevertheless, you've still got idiots in the British Parliament who seem to think that we're somehow at war with Islamic extremism while our special forces are training them out to shoot down aeroplanes.
Well, before we go back to talking about Syria, you mentioned 9/11 there, Martin. Of course, this is at the root of a lot of this, this whole idea that America can go around the world attacking anybody because of the 9/11 attacks. And a couple of months ago, I spoke to a guy who works with kids called Des K, and he's put together what I thought was quite a nice little children's poem about 9/11. So I thought we'd have a listen to that.
A little poem that I put together by Des K, The Grand Illusion. The whole world changed, or so they say, when 9/11 came our way. It came as a jolt from humankind, but of the cause, we seem completely blind. It changed the history of our world, but don't believe all you've been told. It's a story that you just can't buy. Some amateur pilots in the sky? Do you think those planes are so easy to steer? It's all designed to increase our fear. The quick collapse of each twin tower? Airline fuel doesn't have that power. Watch the film, it's there for all. Building 7 straight down in free fall. Could a building fall with one small blaze? You tell that to the people and their eyes start to glaze. The truth is there for all to see. Incendiary dust, a significant key. We seem to have become the collective fool. Fire-wrecked towers don't collapse as a rule. Why, none have fallen before that time. Burning infernos, but the steel stays fine. The newsreel gives us this hint, the buildings fall in their own footprint. And the plane that hit the Pentagon, a commercial airline, just seems wrong. Lots of fire and many sparks, 8-ton engines that leave no marks. We must wake up and smell the thermite if we want to make our future bright. Apprehend the ones who lied, we owe it to all those who died. We need a new Woodward and Bernstein to rock the boat, the internet is the new deep throat. The world is ruled by a very small crowd, although they work in silence. Their influence is loud. It won't be long before they lose their crown. It's their world that's falling down. Can't fall all of the time. The truth is clear. Look online. Close to getting the riddle solved. If you want to see justice, get involved. Do you want a world that's run by crooks, spying on our lives through the nooks, who treat us like we're disposable toys, playing with victims like excitable little boys? Get angry, get angry, get angry, then stop. Take a deep, deep breath. Don't pick up a rock. See what it is that is making the change. Turning around is within our range. The internet for collective voice, making revolutions through a common choice and creating a difference on the ground. A common purpose is being found, working for the cause of all humanity. Finding the truth will set us free.
So great, Des K there with his poem. I'd like, it'd be nice to hear that in the schools around, primary schools around Bristol. But anyway, Martin, he works, he does something called what he calls savetheworldclub.org. But in fact, this stuff is very simple. In many parts of the world, this is taken as read, isn't it?
It is. I mean, for example, General Ivashov was a commander of the Russian armed forces on 9/11. People can check him online. He's very calmly and very quietly said all along, well, we don't believe a word you're saying here. We think you did it. And of course, if the head of the Russian armed forces says that, they will be making, and they will have reasons for saying that, which it's pretty obvious just by watching what happened that there's something not right about it. But no doubt the KGB or the FSB will have their ways of finding out what's been going on, and they know. And they've been basically trying to deal with an out of control US government ever since. And that's not to say that there haven't been similar incidents inside the Russian Federation, because that's the real world we live in, where basically terrorists are embedded within the intelligence infrastructure.
One of the lines Des has got in that poem is, their world is falling down. Well, it's good timing, isn't it? Because with Deutsche Bank on the brink. I mean, what would happen if Deutsche Bank did collapse this weekend?
Well, what would happen, quite possibly, is you're going to get a global crash on Monday morning. That's what will happen. I mean, when it happens, it will happen, and then there will. And of course, at that point, I suspect that the people behind all of this will have their plan to try and drag us to war or whatever to try and cover up their failure to manage the economy properly. And but wars are revolutionary things; they really are. And they're playing with fire.
But it could be the other way around, couldn't it? It could be that a war breaks out, and then the crash is blamed on that. I mean, they tried to blame Brexit could cause a crash. But actually, that's not quite true, is it? A war or Brexit? The crash is there, ready to go.
If you look at when the First World War broke out, there was immediately a crash, and the stock markets around the world were closed, and then the governments had to adopt methods to run the economy without the stock market. So one of the things they did in Britain, for example, is they made the Bradbury pounds, which were basically issued by the government rather than by the Bank of England, which was still private at that stage, and they started to fund the war effort with money that the government had printed itself rather than sourced in the banking system. That changed later in the war. But the thing about wars is it then forces the issue of how are you going to manage the economy when the private sector has collapsed. But of course, I suspect what will happen, it'll be the crash and the war will be simultaneous, and as it was in the beginning of World War One, where the run up to World War Two, you had the crash, then an interval, then the war. But in World War One, it was simultaneous, and I think World War Three will be simultaneous.
We did a programme, didn't we, a few years ago about what it would look like on a Friday night if the banks did crash, because this is when it happens. The stock markets crash or close, etc. So I'll put a link to that old show on our show page tonight, which is thisweek.org.uk. But in a nutshell, Martin, what does happen over the next few days?
Well, I imagine that what will happen is that the Germans will agree to bail out Deutsche Bank. And hopefully they will then hope that will stop the rot, but it then puts the German government in a difficult position, because they'll have to allow others to do similar things for their own banking systems. So that will then create a political row within the European Union about what is acceptable and what is not acceptable policy. That would be a positive outcome. A negative outcome would be that the fact is that nobody manages to deal with the consequences of the collapse, and it just Deutsche Bank is so big that it'll pull everything else down with it.
Okay, so as I said, we're going back to Syria now, and this is because I hadn't ever heard hardly any Syrian government officials speaking on the news over here, and I think we're at a very important time in Syria with the breakdown of this ceasefire and the apparent about to finally liberate Aleppo from these various terrorist groups. So I thought we'd have a listen to the Syrian ambassador to the UN, Bashar al-Jafari, and here he is talking in the street in New York this week to Caleb Maupin, who was over at the United Nations.
Our main message is that we are fed up, enough is enough. We need a genuine partners from the whole world combating terrorists. Some people are hypocrites because they pretend on one hand fighting the terrorists, but on the other hand they are backing them. On one hand, this is number one. Number two, the same people are saying that their main enemy is President Assad, not Daesh, not ISIL. Then you cannot combat ISIL when you say that, because you are hypocrites. You are not addressing the main issue. Third point, you have nothing to do with who should rule over Syria. The Syrian people should decide who should rule over them. The Syrian people will not decide who should be the successor of Obama in the United States. So we are the ones who will decide. This is democracy. If they believe in democracy, this is democracy. The fourth point is that we have 101 member states out of 193 member states in the United Nations exporting to us their own terrorist garbage. These terrorist garbage are not opposition. They are mercenaries and foreigners. They are coming to kill our own people with the Saudi money, the Turkish training, the American backing, the Qatari money, etc., etc. So enough is enough. The mask has fallen and we are fed up. No justification to anybody while accusing us of doing anything wrong. We are not doing anything wrong. We are defending our country by all the means, legal means.
I mean, what he's effectively saying is that there are lots of groups that are interfering in Syria from outside.
That's pretty obvious. It's been obvious all along. Many of the rebels inside Aleppo, including this al-Nusra Front chap we were mentioning earlier, are not in fact Syrians.
You heard the statement from this general who said about basically that a no-fly zone would require going to war with Syria and Russia.
I mean, this is blah, blah, blah. This is nonsense. It will not fly. They know, the generals, they know that it will not fly. The Americans, diplomats as well as military, are trying to justify their wrongdoings in their zone by saying, you know what, we made a mistake in bombing your soldiers in their zone, but the Russians also made a mistake in bombing the humanitarian convoy. So they are trying to create a parallel between their own big mistake when they bombed the Syrian military position by pretending that the Russians did the same. On the other hand, bombing the humanitarian convoy, which is not true, by the way, which is not true, because there are no holes on the ground. The convoys were not bombed. There are no holes on the ground. And we are doing our own national investigation to know who did it. And we will share it with the UN. But again and again and again, the American administration is not genuine. It's not a genuine broker. And they don't have the will to respect the terms of reference of their own agreement with the Russians. Washington was not even able to respect the terms of reference for 7 days. 7 days of cessation of hostilities, they couldn't hold it because they don't have the political will. They are pretending that, you know what, we cannot separate the terrorists of al-Nusra Front from the other so-called moderate opposition. This is ridiculous. If you cannot separate these terrorists from those terrorists, then don't pretend that you want to make a cessation of hostilities decision for 7 days.
That was Bashar al-Jafari, and he was speaking in the street, as you might have saw about the sound quality there, in New York, to Caleb Maupin, Martin.
I think it's fairly clear that what happened was that, for whatever reason, Kerry was negotiating with Lavrov about this ceasefire, and the attack on the Syrian army position at Des Azur was a deliberate ploy by Ash Carter at the Pentagon to sabotage the peace plan being cooked up by Kerry and Obama. So Obama is a lame duck president. He's got some instincts of the right kind, but he's surrounded by maniacs who are determined to have a full-on war with Syria and Russia. And I'm afraid at this stage of the game, I would advise the Syrians and the Russians to stop talking and finish off fighting. And if, for example, the RAF send their planes over the border into Syria, just shoot them down. Shoot them straight away.
Why?
Because they shouldn't be there. They've got no legal basis to be there. And if they come over the border, especially after the killing of six... You see, it was a very significant killing, those soldiers, because they were holding high ground, which allowed the airport to continue to function, which allows them to carry the whole city to be protected from ISIS
attack.
So
you're suggesting it wasn't a mistake?
No, it wasn't a mistake. Absolutely not. The Syrians and the Russians have said, we don't think it was a mistake. Now, if it's not a mistake, that's a fairly clear signal by Dunford, who's the head of the Pentagon, and Ash Carter, who's head of defence. And they basically said afterwards, don't presume that we wouldn't do that again. Now, the fact is that that's a fairly clear signal. They're not on board with Obama's policy of ceasefire. The ceasefire's over. Now let's finish the war, because of course, the reason why they're making such a fuss about Aleppo is if Aleppo can be captured, then the war is virtually over and NATO lost. So that's what they can't accept.
Well, we mentioned briefly the involvement of Israel in the Syria conflict there, effectively on the same side as al-Nusra. Shimon Peres' funeral today, all the great statesmen, supposed great statesmen of the world going over to his funeral.
Well, the Israelis have been involved in the Yinon plan, was put forward in the 1980s, which was to balkanize and create civil conflicts in all of Israel's neighbors to allow Israel to dominate the region.
Well, when you say balkanize, I mean, you were over there in the original Balkans. Yeah. What does it mean?
Well, it's a phrase that just means breaking up existing states into smaller bits, which are much weaker than the larger states, and therefore, you know, Syria has been a consistent opponent of Israeli policy since 1948. And, of course, all the chaos within Syria now and the problems they're having created by NATO and the Gulf Cooperation Council and the Israelis mean that they are much less of a problem for the Israelis to worry about. We've got reports from the Syrians that the Israelis have actually got operations rooms inside Syria working with British and other intelligence officers. And coming back to the Aleppo attack, I mean, the white helmets were the ones who put the photographs out that showed these trucks that had been burned out. He's quite right there. They hadn't been bombed. They'd been burned out. And the Russians then show a video footage of a military vehicle with the convoy.
Who are these white helmets?
Well, the white helmets, that, did you know, they get £28 million a year from the British government. The EU also fund them, and so do the US. And they're actually run by a guy called James Le Mesurier, who's an ex-British intelligence officer, now running his own company. And, of course, he's got no background in civil defence. He's actually a psychological warfare officer. So what the white helmets do is they go around taking selfies of themselves, digging people out of rubble and so on and so forth. But they operate only in areas controlled by Al-Qaeda. And the guys that was actually... The guy who actually shot the film of the little boy, for example, with the dusty little boy the other day, he's actually shown in another video where he's chatting with these guys who'd actually beheaded this Palestinian boy who was accused of being a spy for the Syrian government. Now, in other words, the white helmets are not an independent civil defence force. They are embedded with Al-Qaeda and funded by MI6, run by this guy Le Mesurier. Now, in any decent world, Le Mesurier should be in prison. And, of course, in some countries, he would have to be executed. But he's not. He's on our payroll. We are paying for that.
We heard on the 12th of this month, in The Guardian, Facebook and Israel are working together to monitor posts that incite violence. And then, literally this week, almost a kind of counter to that, Facebook apologises for disabling Palestinian journalists' accounts.
Well, but we know that the big US... communications giants, the Facebook, Google, etc., are working with their intelligence services, A, to spy on people, and B, to spin propaganda for war. I mean, we know that, don't we?
What about back to the Shimon Peres' funeral? The guest list is pretty impressive, including Prince Charles, Boris Johnson, David Cameron, Tony Blair, Francois Hollande, and other heads of state. What do you make of this? A lot of people will be pointing the finger at the Israeli state and saying, well, actually, these people are fundamentalists from a Jewish point of view.
Well, Peres, to be fair, is regarded by the far right in Israel as a bit of a moderate and a bit of a liberal. That doesn't mean much in the real world, because I think he's very embedded within the intelligence structure of the Israeli state. And it's quite possible that he's been involved in a lot of the skullduggery we're discussing.
The kippah is this hat they wear. I mean, just putting a kippah on doesn't actually make you a Jew, does it?
Well, I mean, people can, who is and who is not a Jew is actually a cause of considerable rancour within Israel itself.
I mean, is it a legitimate debate, or is it anti-Semitic just to discuss it?
Well, I mean, people are going to row and argue about it, because people row and argue about religious matters, as they always have. I mean, you know, some people say that the Pope's the Antichrist if they've got a very extreme Protestant view. It's not my view, but some people say it. You know, the Reverend Ian Paisley springs to mind, and somebody used to say that sort of thing.
Also, I suppose with this funeral, I mean, we should also mention that back in 2012 on this show, we broke this story about Ben Fellows and having infiltrated the security for the London Olympics. Shimon Peres was due to have his own special place, G4S had sorted out for him, right in the centre of the Olympic Park. And when he was denied that by the British Army when they took over, he said, I'm not coming to the Olympics then.
Well, G4S have got a very strong relationship with the Israeli state. They run their prisons and other institutions, and the Israelis are very heavily embedded in that private security world.
Also, Robert Fisk wrote an article this week saying Shimon Peres was definitely not a man of peace.
Well, indeed, he's been presented in the West as a moderate, when in actual fact his record is not really that moderate at all. And by their fruit shall ye know them. I mean, the fact is that Israel as a society has drifted further and further to the right and more extreme as time has gone on.
Okay, finally, as I promised, breaking the taboo of religion in politics. This is a part of a talk by a chap called Eustace Mullins, who believes there's a lot of religion, hidden religion, involved in politics.
So everything within the occult is a mirror image of the Christian faith. There is Satan. There is the Antichrist. There is the false prophet. The one thing that's convinced me more than anything else is the validity of the scriptures, is because these people believe in the Gospels. They believe in the Bible. They just hate everything that's there. And they have chosen to worship a different God. And this is really what motivates people at the highest levels of our government. Who is the angel who rides in the whirlwind and directs this storm? And if you read the President Bush's first inaugural address, this is how he concludes it, referring twice, not once, but twice to the angel who rides in the whirlwind and directs the storm. It's Lucifer. Now, whether George Bush understands this or not, I don't know. He is part of a Luciferian organization. If you don't know anything about Skull and Bones, you need to get my 4-tape set on Skull and Bones. You need to get the new book we're carrying on satanic crimes, because they've actually gotten in and gotten video cameras of the initiation at Skull and Bones. And as you know, both George Bush and his father and his grandfather and John Kerry, who ran against George Bush in 2004, they all come from Skull and Bones. And in the inauguration, they kneel before Lucifer. The book is, of course, Satanic Crimes, researched by a very courageous young man named William H. Kennedy. And it's available through our ministry. Understand, we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. Today, there is a conscious, organized effort to destroy the sovereignty of our nation. It is part of a worldwide plan. It is being carried out in Europe with the formation of the European Union. It doesn't matter that the people of France and of the Netherlands have voted against the Constitution. They don't care what the people want, you common people. You're standing in the way of progress, this wonderful dream that they've been working for thousands of years to accomplish.
the voice of Eustace Mullins there. Certainly not necessarily the views on this show. But Martin, we were talking earlier, weren't we, about the whole business of the possibility of Deutsche Bank collapsing at some point, kind of Lehman Brothers style. But it's also true in the United States at the moment, because Congress has rejected Obama's veto of this 9/11 bill. And the 9/11 bill was to stop the 9/11 bill will allow US citizens to sue the Saudis for the 9/11 attacks. Now, they've said that they're going to withdraw nearly $1 trillion worth of investments from the US if they allow this to go through, and Congress have just said it's going through.
Well, underlying all of this is that the Saudis, the Israelis and the NATO intelligence services were the main perpetrators of 9/11, and of course gradually it's coming out and they're all pointing the finger at each other. But of course, for those of us on the outside, for example the Russian General Staff and General Ivashov, who's now retired, it's all very interesting, isn't it? World War III is going to be a bit of a blinder for all of us.
But it's a bit like the child sex abuse inquiry we were talking about at the beginning. So it's difficult for the 9/11 victims and families right at the beginning, but what's worse is the cover-up. I mean, for example, they had somebody who was running their campaign who wasn't even a victim of 9/11 for about 4 or 5 years in the mid-2000s.
Well, indeed, and there's a chap called Matt, I've forgotten his second name, whose brother was killed in the Twin Towers, who's been campaigning in this country. Ultimately, this will come out as part of World War III. If we're going to war with Russia, the Russians are going to dump everything they've got on this out into the internet and give us telephone intercepts, everything we need.
OK, time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Coming up, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Cabinet Member for Finance, Governance and Performance. Quite a job there, Labour Councillor for Hillfields, Craig Cheney. Our sister show Dialects on every Tuesday. We can hear Sam Hill again, interview with her. Also, our show page for your comments is onewordthisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter @TonyGosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.